that's not about public defenders as a whole. And I'm saying this as one of the most bulldog, rabid prosecutors, scorched earth on planet Earth. Okay? But I do understand that there are public defenders who do their job well. And I also agree that money can be a factor sometimes. So again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. You are listening to the Sunday Forum, where we are talking about wrongful convictions and that it's better that 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. So, you know, one thing I want to get to, and I'm actually, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over a couple of pieces. Well, actually, you know what? We have time because I'm almost there to the race bit, and I want to get into that heavy, okay? Because, you know, if Kaya Wright's on the mic, we're going to get into racism heavy, okay? Heavy, okay? So, again, give us a call at 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663, if you have any questions or comments about what we've been talking about today. And I also want to give a shout-out. You know, I thought about this a couple of weeks ago when we had DJ Smell So Good, who was one of our regulars on Facebook. And we'll get to your comments after the second break, Facebook. But I remember, you know, he's always on Facebook, and he ended up calling one time, actually for the second time, and got to kind of hear his voice. And, you know, I told him I appreciated him listening and being a supporter. And then I thought about the fact that, you know, we have a lot of individuals in prison, especially given this particular topic, who are also regular listeners. So I just want to give a shout out to you all, you know, Reggie, Artist Scarborough, some other folks who regularly listen to the show, you know, and because you can't get on Facebook or whatever and call in or whatever, you know, you send me letters, and sometimes you agree with what I said and sometimes not, you know, but I want you to know, just like I did when DJ Smell So Good called in, I do appreciate you listening and telling other folks about the show and defending me when I said I don't date white women and, you know, whatever the case may be, okay? So, again, I wanted to give a shout-out to you guys. But to continue on with the interview and the examples of misconduct, the examples of official misconduct, this is what Seth had to say.
Yeah, there's tremendous pressure on law enforcement to solve crime, and in many cases the persistence of crime is in a lot of ways overhyped, and so you know, it's a political issue for elected sheriffs
being tough on crime and all
leaders.
To clean up
the neighborhoods, be tough on crime, and so there's so much focus on case closure rates in a data-driven world of policing now, and so what you see is that you know, we can't, as law enforcement, have unsolved crimes, and we just have to figure out ways to solve them. And the way that's manifested in some instances, though not just a very small minority of instances, but still really important, is individual law enforcement officers fabricating evidence against individuals in a systematic way in order to get their case closure rates up. We saw it in Jackson County with fabricated drug possessions where the drugs were planted. It's in the panhandle of Florida, and as you stated, in Biscayne Park in Miami. And that police chief went to prison for 3 years.
Right.
Was just sentenced. But a number of people were victims of that police misconduct. And of course, they'll never be made fully whole because they've lost portions of their life.
Exactly. And so, you know, you think about, again, the impact of that kind of misconduct on the lives of those who have been adversely affected. But, you know, another thing, and you know, you guys who listen to the show, you know how I am about the whole people of color bit and, you know, the deflections to other groups. Other groups aren't affected like black people, okay? There are effects amongst other group members, but it's different for black people. We are disproportionately wrongfully convicted. If you go right now to the website of Innocence Project Florida, or you go to Innocence Project writ large once again, and look at all the exonerees, most of them, the overwhelming majority of those people are black people. Okay? You have a couple of Hispanics, you have a couple of white people, but most of those people are black people. And there's a great report that I encourage you all to read, you know, at your leisure, you know, after you're done listening to the Sunday Forum. Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. It's called Race and Wrongful Convictions. It was published in March of 2017, so quite recent, by the National Registry of Exonerations, which is run by the University of California, Irvine, and the University of Michigan and Michigan State Law Schools. So that's a rare occasion you'll see Michigan State and University of Michigan together doing something great. So instead of just being rivals. So, but a very, very, very good report. And it's actually infuriating, the details here on WMNF Tampa. So just a couple of things. I don't have time to go through all of it. I'm just going to give you a couple of the highlights. Innocent black people were 7 times more likely to be convicted of murder than innocent white people. Innocent black people were 3.5 times more likely to be convicted of sexual assault than innocent white people. And innocent blacks were 12 times, let me say that again, 12 times more likely to be convicted of drug crimes than innocent whites. In fact, since 1989, there have been over 1,800 defendants who have been cleared in so-called, quote, group exonerations that followed 15 large-scale police scandals, this is from the report, in which officers systemically framed innocent defendants. And the great majority of those were black people, African-Americans, who were framed for drug crimes. Framed for drug crimes. So, you know, this is a very serious issue. So what I wanted to know is, to what degree does the Innocence Project factor in race and its advocacy, racism in particular, in its advocacy? And this is Seth's response.
So race does play a role in every single aspect of the criminal justice system. And I think, you know, from the innocence perspective, I want to take it out of the innocence perspective, because I think it's an issue that involves all individuals, innocent or guilty, that are going through the criminal justice process. And I think there's a whole array of front-end criminal justice reforms that can be necessary. But it really, to be honest, it really all starts with who we elect and put in positions of leadership. I think what you've seen around the country in the, just the last couple of years is a real effort to elected prosecutors, elected sheriffs, elected judges, elected public defenders, people of color who can, you know, these offices, they've run by virtue of the culture that is created by the leaders of those offices. So if you have leadership in offices, in prosecutor's offices or sheriff's department that tolerates actions that disproportionately impact people of color, then that's what's going to happen. And if you have leadership that understands that we are going to get rid of our cash bail system that disproportionately impacts poor people of color and makes them plead to crimes that they didn't commit so they can get out of jail, mm-hmm. so they don't lose their job, their house, their family, their children, that's an important reform. But it's taken, in many places, the election of black prosecutors to say, like, look, we're going to do this because we understand that this has a disproportionate impact on people of color in our community. I think, and this is happening in a bunch of different places, and like that by itself is going to have a major impact, in terms of policing, in terms of prosecutorial discretion, that is going to diminish the disparate impact that criminal justice system is having on people of color. But, in our work, we are trying really hard to understand, like, how race affects people being wrongfully convicted at every stage of the process, and try to institute litigation, or as part of our litigation, issues related to racial justice, so that we can sort of sensitize courts to understand that this is a thing. Just because we're past the civil rights era, and just because we've had a black president,
we're not post-racial.
We're not post-racial, right? And so, because in our cases,
So I talked about the taking it out bit, part of his answer. and the fact that I did appreciate that they were incorporating it into their litigation, but that it is just very important. It is very important that we look at the ways in which racism affects all parts of the process. And I did want to go ahead and make sure I got in before we go ahead and wrap his bit up. I want to go ahead and make sure I get in, you know, his response to that, because I was wondering about why the need to take that bit out, but he explained that, and I wanted to make sure I included that.
So the reason I suggested taking it out of the innocence context is because sometimes we think of the criminal justice system. We only want to talk about innocence, and innocence work is necessarily, wrongful conviction work is necessarily narrow, but the same issues of racial bias that cause someone to be wrongfully convicted cause miscarriage of justice, even in cases where someone might be guilty but shouldn't be convicted. And so, we don't want, a hyper focus on innocence to make people think if we just fix the problems in innocence world, then we've fixed all the problems. We haven't really even scratched the surface.
Oh yeah, tip of the iceberg.
What you had mentioned is really important. I mean, we're not, when we see a lot of issues related to wrongful convictions of women of color who kill their batterers, mm-hmm. who kill their abusers, who kill their pimps. And these are women who are acting in self-defense, yet we don't believe them. And mm-hmm. yet, on the flip side of that, we're regularly acquitting white people because we are accepting their stereotypes about black men and black boys, the racist stereotypes, as a basis for a reasonable fear that mm-hmm. will be a foundation for a self-defense, affirmative defense. And
so I want to go ahead and move on, but and then the last thing I did is asked him, how it is that people can get in contact. So just Google Innocence Project Florida and head on over there if you have any questions. So, really, really great interview with Seth, great information, very knowledgeable. And I was very much focused at the end there on the fact that when it comes to, and that's why he mentioned actually self-defense, and I've talked about this before, and I'm going to make this point, and we're going to go to a break and come back with State Attorney Warren. Again, this is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, and we are discussing wrongful convictions and our theme, better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. And the issue is this, okay? When it comes to something like self-defense, for example, where you have your fear of death or serious bodily harm needs to be reasonable, right? And to the degree that we have a myriad of studies that show that black people are seen as innately criminal, innately violent, etc., which then informs your reasonable fear, to the degree that we continue to fail to address this salient point, it gets skirted over all the time. We have, they did the point system. I'm not from Florida, but I know y'all had the point system to try to deal with the racism, et cetera. But another piece that is not addressed is when it comes to those jurors, it's almost as if people have thrown up their hands about it. It's like, well, there's nothing we can do if that's what their reasonable fear is. No, we need to get to the bottom of the ways in which race, because the only group the group of people who is impacted by this are black people. Okay? In the most significant ways when it comes to death, people being allowed to shoot us, et cetera. And when they talk about their reasonable fear, I think a long time ago there was an old white lady. She saw like three black men coming towards her, and she said she feared for her life and shot them or something. And I think she was acquitted. I'm not sure whatever happened in the case, but I never kind of forgot that. And it informs this issue of black people being held to this other standard by virtue of not our skin color. I always say that. I don't like to say it's on our skin color. It's on people's sociopathology about our skin color. It's their issue. It's not our skin color. Our skin color is neutral. Okay? But the fact that you have these continual examples, be it, who are we going to frame? Says the Baltimore cops or says the Miami cops. Who am I going to pull over and rape? Says Daniel Holzclaw. Who am I going to blame for false crimes?
WMNF. Tampa.
Who, Okay, thank you, Lo. Who are we going to blame for sundry crimes? You know, we see that all the time, right? You know, people convicted, I've talked about this before, and turns out they just made up a random person. There are 7.6 billion people on planet Earth. You know, hundreds of ethnicities, bunches of races. You could have picked anybody, but you picked black time and time again. So that needs to be addressed. So, you know, a definite issue that I don't think gets enough attention at all. But hey, going to take a breather here because, you know, I'm hyped up. So I need to calm back down. And we have a caller we're going to get to, and then we're going to go to our break, and then we're going to get to Andrew Warren. Caller, you are on WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. Can you please tell us your name and where you're calling from?
This is Chris Steiner in Clearwater. Do you read me?
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm well. Well, any mention of jurors should involve the rights for jurors to acquit and how to overcome when judges and prostituting attorneys commit jury tampering by repeatedly, continually misdirecting juries of their rights to vote their consciences and claiming that they must apply the law that's charged to what facts that the jury believes to be true. In contrary, this misdirection are many legal precedents and quotes from the Founding Fathers at the Fully Informed Jury Association's website, FIJA.org. Jurors can vote their consciences, meaning they can acquit for any reason they like. And examples include if the accused has already made restitution or the law is misapplied, the law is silly or unconstitutional, they've no victimless alleged crime, or even if they feel that it's just ruling against the constitutional laws, they can decide to acquit. If they feel like there's prison overcrowding, they can do that too. Now, as a juror, it only takes one to hang a jury. But in order to accomplish it, you have to do it secretly because your fellow jurors will probably inform the judge that you're voting your conscience and risks being dismissed from the jury and possibly being held in contempt by the judge. So what you need to do is just say that you don't believe the evidence was convincing, or you don't believe the person. If you can't find unconvincing evidence to cite, then just say, well, you don't believe the person would have committed the crime, if it's not in their character. So that's what you need to do, and could just quietly exercise your right, not try to go in for a big win of a unanimous decision with the jury. So I think this is the most potent weapon, this jury nullification, that we the people can use to prevent the prosecution of the innocent, slowing and stopping the conveyor belt, cash register, prison industrial justice system.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Chris. And we're going to have to move on. But thank you for your comment. And obviously, you know, jury nullification is going to destroy a case. Okay. And, you know, that's not something that attorneys can advocate for in any way, shape or form, you know, but obviously, you know, jurors get on TV all the time, which is unusual because in the system that I prosecuted in, the jurors were not allowed. They couldn't do that. They couldn't talk about deliberations. They couldn't talk about, I mean, they could talk about general impressions, but they couldn't get into details like they can out here. So obviously, you know, people have different reasons for deciding what they decide, period, point blank. I mean, we've heard, you know, it was juror 58 or 53, whoever from George Zimmerman, who, you know, you listen to her talk about why she didn't believe the evidence, and you're like, you know, what were you even doing? You know, what were you even doing there? So, you know, you have various things, but no, we're not going to, you know, have jury nullification. And so, hey, listen, we're going to go to our break, and as always, we're going to go in with a cut. And this one is by special request of Dean from Walter's campaign, because he says I remind him of Sid, which I don't know how to take that, but of the internet. And the internet is a neo-soul, so is a neo-soul group. So they're right in line with our theme when it comes to the Sunday Forum with Kaya Wright and playing some underground neo-soul for you all. And this is a cut called Under Control by the Internet from their album Ego Death.
Woke up impatient and anxious, chasing dreams in my sleep. Got me feeling like I made it. Then I wake up and see frustrations raising for payment. Thankfully they know me. Can't get enough for the paper. Get enough for. I know you love it, babe, 'cause I'm a risk.
Do you have closets or shelves filled with record albums that you've not listened to for years?
Just take those old records off the shelf.
We can find new homes for your old LPs. Donate them to WMNF for our annual record and CD sale coming in April. Bring your albums to the station, and for big collections in good condition, we will come for pickup. Call 813-238-8001 for more information.
Welcome back to WMNF Tampa. If you have a car you no longer need, think about using it to support WMNF. Donating a car, truck, or other vehicle is a great way to support the causes you care most about, like your station. Visit WMNF.org or call 1-888-966-3885. Now back to the Sunday Forum, Kaya Wright, and the 4th Estate, WMNF Tampa.
All right, all right. Welcome back again. We are 88.5. This is the Sunday Forum, like Lo said. And we are going to bring on our guest, Andrew Warren. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Kai. Happy Sunday. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, for those of you who do not know, Andrew Warren is the Hillsborough County State Attorney. Now, there are 20 judicial districts in Florida, and so there are 20 state attorneys, and he is one of those, and he is, again, responsible for prosecuting cases, amongst other things, but ultimately responsible for prosecuting cases in Hillsborough County, which includes Tampa, Temple Terrace, and Plant City. But here's the first question I have, actually. So you're born and raised in, I know you got this all the time. You're born and raised in Gainesville, Florida. Okay? But you end up at Brandeis in Massachusetts and then Columbia University for law school. So how did that happen?
Well, first of all, let me express my condolences for the family of Josiah Pinner, the young man who was killed crossing the street on Friday night in, Hillsborough County has, 50 to 60 traffic fatalities a year involving pedestrians and cyclists.
Wow.
And this is just one more tragedy taking an innocent life. And my hearts and thoughts, prayers go out to the family who I know are suffering this weekend with that tragic loss. In terms of my background, born and raised in Gainesville, diehard Gator, and was fortunate enough to earn a scholarship to Brandeis University. was interested in getting out of Gainesville to see the United States a little bit and, mm-hmm. and to change my perspective and try to get out of my comfort zone to expand my mind during college, and was fortunate enough after Brandeis to be able to go to Columbia University for law school, and I loved it. It was great being in New York. It's a fantastic institution. I got a great education there, and I'm still paying for it today.
Know about those law school loans indeed. So let's talk about Conviction Review Unit. This is why I reached out to your office when I heard about this, and I understand it's something you all just stood up, so it's relatively new in November. So what exactly is the Conviction Review Unit, and why did you stand it up? It's one of only about 35 in the country, so relatively rare. So what is the Conviction Review Unit?
Well, Conviction Review Unit's a specialized unit within a prosecutor's office that the purpose of it is to identify whether an innocent person has been wrongly convicted, and if so, to fix it. I mean, we are trying to catch mistakes in the system and to prevent more mistakes from happening in the system. That's the purpose of it. I mean, it's very straightforward. I talk about my mission as state attorney all the time as being to build a safer community while promoting justice and fairness for everyone who comes through a court system. And our mission for justice doesn't end when a case is closed. We know that mistakes happen in the system. Now we have a mechanism to go back and do something about it, and that's what the Conviction Review Unit's for.
Okay, awesome. Again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. We have as our guest, and we are on with State Attorney Andrew Warren. Give us a call at 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663 if you have any questions. I know we had a caller that was dropped earlier, so caller, feel free to call back. Now, let's talk about the scope of the CRU. We'll get into the details of the process later, but does it include simply wrongful convictions, or is there a mechanism for reducing charges? Let's say you get a particular case in and there was a Brady violation or something like that. Do charges get reduced maybe to a lesser included offense or any over sentencing that's addressed, or is it just convictions, period?
It's really just for convictions because it's looking at closed cases. So if you have a case, an active case where there is a discovery violation, a Brady violation, as you say, then we'll take the appropriate remedies in the context of that case while it's still being prosecuted.
Okay.
And maybe dismissing the charges or whatever the remedies are. But the Conviction Review Unit is focused on historical cases. Mm. We're looking back to see, have we made a mistake? Is there an innocent person sitting in prison for a crime that he or she didn't commit? And I'll tell you, the motivation behind this was, you know, from the very first day as a prosecutor, anyone who's a prosecutor knows and has to think about the possibility that they make a mistake and they convict an innocent person. And you have hope and faith in the system that you're doing the right thing, that the system is going to catch those things, that the evidence and the burden on the state to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt with the appellate process, we have all these checks in the system to make sure that we don't convict that one innocent person versus the 10 or 100 guilty that may go free. But we wanted to make sure that we had this mechanism in place because even though I understood the concept and I'd studied it and I looked at what was going on in other places, the first time I sat down with people who had been wrongfully convicted, men and women who had been on death row in this country for crimes they did not commit, and I'm not talking about they were acquitted on a technicality. I mean, they did not commit the crime for which they spent 10, 20 years in prison waiting to be executed by the state. It's gut-wrenching, it really is. As a prosecutor, to know that that can happen in a system that I've spent my career in, that I have so much faith and confidence in, shakes you to your core, and we were intent on doing something about it here.
Kaya, if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, question for you. This is Lo, Ms. Warren. So the question for you that I have is about the Innocence Project, as far as like, what is your relationship with the Innocence Project, and do you try to make a bridge with them and to see if they can be helpful and impactful to the cases that you're reviewing?
Absolutely. So my relationship with the Innocence Project is frankly similar to that with other defense attorneys. In the context of a particular case, we are somewhat adversaries, right? We go into the courtroom, we have our own position to represent. Outside of the context of a particular case, though, most of us want the same thing. We want our community safe. We want fairness and justice in the system. So the Innocence Project has been a great partner in establishing conviction review units around the country. Kai and I were talking about before I came on the show about how Barry Scheck, the founder of the Innocence Project, had put together a best practices for conviction review units that we followed, that a lot of other offices around the country have followed. To have Barry Scheck's support in launching our conviction review unit is a great thing. And so no one wants an innocent person to be convicted of a crime. So the Innocence Project works with us, and we're hopeful that they will be able to get cases to us for us to review, because they know what they're doing and identifying cases where there may have been a wrongful conviction.
Great.
Yes, and you know, that point about justice, that's a, and I said that earlier, but that really is a prosecutor's job. You know, you're supposed to ensure that justice is done. And if that means somebody's got to go, or, you know, you find something, it's not a, you know, some people get into this, you know, my wins, and it's not about that, okay? It's about justice being done, because you obviously don't want the wrong person in there. And I know I never brought a case where I didn't believe that the individual was guilty of the crimes that I had charged him with. So,
and Kai, I think that's a great point. I mean, I talk about how our job in building a safer community extends beyond the walls of the courthouse. We're looking to prevent crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more effective to prevent crime than to deal with it afterwards. And just like that mission isn't confined to the courthouse walls, that mission is not confined during the pendency of a case.
Mm-hmm.
When a case is closed, if something, we realize that there may have been a mistake made, we got to go back and look at it. And to your point about not prosecuting cases that you didn't believe in, I've had conversations with prosecutors in my office where when I ask the prosecutor, do you believe the person committed the crime? And they're talking about, well, we can argue this, we can argue that. Mm-hmm. So no. You're the person closest to the case. You know the facts the best. You're briefing me on it, but you've been living this now.
Right.
Do you believe the person committed the crime? They said, no, I don't. So then we have to dismiss the charges.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you, as the prosecutor who knows the facts the best, doesn't think that the person committed the crime, we shouldn't be going forward on the charge.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I know we got a call again, but let me get to another question here just really quick. So, what is actually, and let me just reiterate, you're focused on Hillsborough County crimes, right? So
correct.
Not Pasco County and all that. So
my
so,
jurisdiction's limited
right,
Hillsborough.
To Hillsborough County. So I just wanted to make that clear for folks mm-hmm. who are listening, because we have folks listening all over Florida, all over the world, actually, all over the country. And I want to make that clear. So what exactly is the application review process? So, you know, how does an individual who thinks that he or she may have been wrongfully convicted of a crime in Hillsborough County go about utilizing this process?
Sure. So let me walk through sort of the four-step process, and I'll do it pretty quickly. First, we have a screening process to make sure that we have jurisdiction over the crime and that there's a plausible claim of innocence. Someone sending us a petition that says, I'm innocent, doesn't really help us much,
right?
Then we have a review and investigation, meaning we review the file and investigate the case. We have an investigator assigned to the unit with our supervising attorney, full-time attorney, by the way. This is not like we're going to do it on the back of a napkin in our spare time.
Mm-hmm.
We are devoting a full-time staff to doing this because it's a necessary part of any modern prosecutor's office. So we have that review and investigation. We have an outside review panel that will act as consultants to help us make sure that we're seeing things clearly and to offer different perspectives. And then we have my decision. So those are the four steps. The way the process starts with the screening is a petition is submitted to our office. It can be submitted by the actual defendant, by a loved one, by an attorney, by the Innocence Project, whoever.
Okay.
And those petitions are available online at our website, sao13th.com. So sao13th.com. There's a lot of FAQs about how the process works, but those petitions are available on the website, can be submitted in hard copy or electronically.
Okay, awesome. Again, this is WMNF 88.5. For those of you who may have just joined us, WMNF Tampa, this is Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, and we are talking about wrongful convictions. And our theme today is that it is better for 10 guilty persons to go free than for one innocent person. Okay, for one innocent person to suffer. You were going to say something, Lo?
Yeah, and I know, caller, we see you there. We're going to get to you in just a moment. So I wanted a little bit more clarity on the process. So how does this work when it comes to people that have been released, however they, you know, feel like they have been wrongfully convicted? How do you handle those type of cases?
Great question. So we are trying to make the review unit as expansive as possible. We don't want to limit the types of cases that come in beyond what we need to actually accomplish the purpose of it. So whether you were convicted at trial by a jury, whether you pled guilty, both qualify. Whether you're still in prison or you've been out, we're taking both. However, because this is such a resource-intensive process, we're prioritizing more serious cases, so violent felonies, more people, and where the offender or the defendant is still incarcerated. Okay. But we're not limiting it to that. It's just what we're prioritizing.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. That's understood. Okay, let's go to our caller before I get to the rest of our questions here on WMNF 88.5. For those of you, again, who are just joining us. Caller, you are on Sunday Forum. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Sure. Keith from Clearwater.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, what's up? I appreciate the conversation. I'm a legal journalist, and I wanted to address the attorneys. I want to address this question for the attorney. Some cultures in prosecutors' offices are oriented around maximizing convictions, maximizing sentences. And I know I do work with the Innocence Project, and a lot of times judges and prosecutors oppose DNA-confirmed innocence. Maybe they don't want their reputation sullied or their career. Whatever the reason may be, that happens. And so I'm wondering, would you address, sir, the culture in your office, and do you get resistance since you're basically overseeing and maybe ending up making somebody look bad in your office? How does that work?
Well, I think the culture in my office is strong. We have 130 prosecutors and 300 staff, and I think every single one of them agree with the idea that the only person who benefits from a wrongful conviction is the actual perpetrator. They're there doing justice, and keep in mind that these are underpaid and overworked public servants who are dedicated to their job to serve this community. So we haven't had any resistance. We've had a ton of support within the office for it. And it's not a matter of second-guessing mistakes that people made. It's about the problems that come up with wrongful convictions, or sometimes not the blame of any specific person. Now, you could have instances where, you know, it was misconduct by an officer or prosecutor, but actually what the Innocence Project and other organizations have shown, studies have shown that study wrongful convictions, they're usually the result of just weaknesses in evidence that get cumulatively applied in a jury thinks that they have the wrong guy, the right guy, when they don't. We talked about eyewitness misidentification, forensic testing, things like that. So it's usually not there's a bad apple seed out there doing it. It's just the result of systemic problems that exist. And the reality is that when we handle as many cases as we do, unfortunately, wrongful convictions are going to occur. Although rarely, they're still unacceptable.
Yeah, I would be concerned that that your role is may devolve unintentionally into a role where you protect convictions against claims of wrongful conviction to protect the reputation of the state's attorney office. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think
let me hold on. And thank you very much for your question, Keith. And we're gonna move on. But I just want to say very quickly, you know, when it comes to ensuring as a prosecutor that you have the right individual, I've spoken earlier about the wrong attitude that some people can have. But the bottom line is, it is the responsibility of whoever's the chief prosecutor, whoever's the state attorney, district attorney, however that individual is characterized, to ensure that, you know, 'cause they get those people out, because you don't want those people working for you. You know, this is not this notion, and I don't know if people are watching TV or what, but, you know, to the degree that you have a bunch of prosecutors running around, you know, trying to allow someone who has committed a crime to remain free, you know, that's who you want in jail, the person who committed the crime. So you are incentivized, because sometimes things happen, circumstances change, new evidence comes to light, and you should be excited to ensure you get the right person.
So, Keith, I appreciate that question. I'll tell you, I was a federal prosecutor before becoming state attorney. And the motto of the Justice Department, qui pro domina justitia sequitur, is on behalf of justice we prosecute. And there's the story behind that is a prosecutor in England a long time ago was asked about by the Queen about, you know, whether he prosecutes on behalf of the Queen, and his response was, no, I prosecute on behalf of justice. And that's what we do. And I think anyone who has followed what I have done in the past 2 years will know that my commitment is to justice, to fairness, to integrity of the system.
All right. Thanks a lot. Again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. And we are talking to State Attorney Andrew Warren. So talking about the consulting board that you mentioned. So I was reading, and tell me if I have these members correct. Teresa Hall, who is a former prosecutor, defense counsel, and magistrate judge. Peggy Quince, who used to be a Florida Supreme Court justice. Emiliano Jose Salcines, who was an appellate justice. And Chris Altenburn, I might be messing up that last name, also an appellate justice. That's the group that you were referring to?
It is actually, Teresa Hall is the supervising attorney.
Okay.
So she works for the state attorney's office, and she is leading the conviction review unit.
Okay.
The other three individuals, Judge Salcines, Judge Altenburn, and Justice Quince, are some of the most preeminent jurists in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We have two members of former members of the Second District Court of Appeals, so the appellate court that oversees Hillsborough County. We have recently retired Justice Quince, a Florida Supreme Court justice. We have diversity in terms of men and women, white and black, Hispanic, the experience that those three individuals bring. And we are extremely humbled to have three titans of Florida's legal community willing to volunteer to help with this mission.
So given that, you know, obviously as a prosecutor in one case for Teresa Hall, and then the others having been appellate court judges or justices, how do you ensure that there isn't a conflict of any sort? What safeguards when it comes to maybe a case that they may have seen or heard, et cetera, or prosecuted, you know, et cetera? So I just want to be sure that there's transparency and there's a mechanism to address any conflicts that may arise.
So the panel would, their job is really to ask questions, make findings and recommendations to both Teresa as the supervising attorney during her investigation and review, and then ultimately to me as the state attorney to make a final decision.
Okay.
If there's a case where one of those judges had actually sat in judgment on the case, they would recuse from that individual review.
Okay.
That way we can avoid any conflict of interest.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely, when I mean, especially as long as they've been on the bench, and even with Teresa Hall's long career. So just wanted to make sure we address that. So another question I had is, we touched on it a little bit earlier. Again, for those of you who are just joining us, this is WMNF 88.5. Sometimes when I listen back to shows, it seemed like I've gone like a half hour, and I haven't said that. So, you know, if you're wondering, I just want to make sure we get our legal IDs and people understand what it is that we're talking about if you're just tuning in. And again, give us a call at 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663. WMNF, Tampa. All right. Make it happen. So we'll probably go to a quick break here soon and then come back. But what I wanted to ask about was about preventative methods, right? And again, we touched on that earlier a little bit. But are there any reforms or programs or initiatives in the state attorney's office right now or that are in development that address these contributing factors? Because, you know, you talk about the best practices, et cetera. So when it comes to the contributing factors for wrongful convictions, are there things you're doing now to head that off? So, for example, with regards to the false witnesses and how the police may be doing their lineups or anything like that, what are some steps that you all are taking to stop things before we even get to a trial and conviction when it comes to those factors?
Sure. For a minute there, I thought you were asking about what we're doing in the office to prevent crime in general. And I was going to say, how much time do you have? We spend the next week talking about what we've been doing in the past 2 years to actually reduce crime and prevent crime and make sure we're not putting more people into the system.
That'll be another conversation.
Another conversation.
Yeah.
The next time I'm on WMNF 88.5.
That's right.
There you go. See, I can do it too.
Soundbite right there.
I know, right? Go ahead and get that recorded.
But in terms of what we're doing, so the conviction review unit really has two purposes. One is to review cases, and the second is to mitigate the problems from happening in the first place.
Okay.
So we're going to, just like when there's a plane crash, the National Transportation Safety Board goes back and looks at what happened to figure out how this happened and to prevent the likelihood that it happens again. Same thing when you have, you know, someone die in a hospital, right? You have these industries that are set up with their own mechanism to conduct what's called sentinel event review or sentinel event analysis. When you have a big problem that occurs, it's, okay, how did this specific big problem occur? And what lessons do we learn from it so that we reduce the likelihood of it happening again?
Right.
That's what our conviction review unit's going to be doing. So Teresa's job is twofold. It's actually go back and review the cases. And it's also, even in a case where maybe we review it and we determine, yeah, we actually did get the right guy. And we've investigated fully a new claim of innocence that didn't come up. And we, nope, the evidence was there. And sure enough, we did get the right guy. But was there something that could have been done differently to prevent the possibility that we got the wrong guy? Absolutely. We'll go back. We have training for our prosecutors on it. I mean, that's how the system is supposed to work. It's both backwards looking and forwards looking.
So in other words, the CRU's mission includes both preventative and actual substantive review afterwards.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Great. All right, so let's take our caller, and then let's go to a quick break, and then we will come back and finish up. We've got just a couple of questions left, and we're going to get to the racism question, because you know it's not going to be a good day unless I can get to that. But let's hear from the caller. Please give us your name and where you're calling from here on WMNF 88.5. I'm not sure what that is in the background. If you have the radio on, please turn that down, because we're getting feedback.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My name is Craig. I'm calling from Tampa.
All right. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. And my question, first of all, I want to just say thank you to Darren G. Warren's office for, you know, putting together a conviction review unit. I mean, it's definitely important. I'm glad that we're doing it locally. But one important part that I also heard from the Innocence Project interview was that past state attorneys can kind of create a culture, you know, that you know, I guess, precipitates down into the different prosecutors that work within the unit. And so my question is this. We know that Mark Ober in the past, you know, was severely, you know, had a, you know, very severe history of, you know, over-prosecuting folks. You mentioned that 130 attorneys are in your office now. So my question is that it what has really been done to kind of make sure that, you know, those decades that he was in office of training to overconvict has actually been reduced. And I'm asking this kind of from a live example. My bike was stolen a couple of years ago, and, you know, the TBD was great to me. You know, your office was great to me. I have no problem with that. But the only charge that I was given a teenager basically a felony. So it removed his right to vote and everything like that. And I don't want to give a felony. And I even tried talking to the attorney that was on my case, whether I could talk to the stepfather, the family, so we could work something out. And the only way to get out answer out of the game was either a felony conviction or nothing at all. So I ended up dropping the charges because I'm pretty pissed because I never got any kind of justice. So my question is kind of twofold on that.
Well, I don't think it's an issue that was unique to Hillsborough County. I think for an entire generation, prosecutors' offices have been had blinders on. They've been very short-sighted, and they viewed their job as prosecute, convict, incarcerate. Along with lots of criminal justice reformers around the country, we're coming in and implementing a new culture, which is one that reminds our staff and attorneys that our job is to make our community safer. It's to keep the system fair and just to, you know, the best we can. And so making sure that prosecutors understand that there are ways that they can make the community safe outside of simply prosecuting, convicting, incarcerating is key. That's why we expand diversion programs. That's why we create new programs and go out in the community to reduce crime. That's why we make sure that prosecutors aren't judged by simply seeking the maximum charge, the maximum sentence in every case. Instead, they're tasked with seeking the right outcome. Not the harshest one, the right one. In the end, that's what justice is all about.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. Kind of answer the question. I mean, I'm still very concerned because, you know, after decades of Mark Ober, I just feel like you just can't turn that off with a switch. But I did have just a follow-up question.
Yeah, just really, really quickly.
Yeah, really quick. Okay, Larry Krasner ended up dropping about 51 marijuana conviction charges to reduce mass incarceration. Would you consider making that same push here locally?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the beginning of the question.
What was the beginning of your question, caller?
Yeah, it was Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner. He ended up dropping 51 marijuana charges just in mass, so they're not going to pursue those marijuana charges because they realize that it causes mass incarceration. I was wondering, would you be willing to make the same effort here locally?
Well, we have done that with regard to our civil citation program. So for the first time in Hillsborough County history, in 2017, we launched a program for juveniles and for adults for marijuana misdemeanor possession, because we think that while possession of marijuana is illegal, misdemeanor possession shouldn't be something that hangs around someone's neck for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. So we have the civil citation program where somebody essentially goes through probation without being prosecuted, without even having been arrested, where if they comply with the terms of the probation, and it's for all sorts of misdemeanors, not just marijuana possession, but, you know, it can be writing a letter of apology, paying restitution, going to drug treatment, but most importantly, not reoffending. Mm-hmm. And if you don't reoffend, then no charge is ever filed, which means that young person who, when they're applying to college, seeking to join the military, looking for a job, they can say they've never been arrested, they've never been charged, they've never been prosecuted. So that's a way, that's a smart way that we are holding people accountable for what they do, reducing crime, but not making it a punishment that impacts someone the rest of their life for a relatively simple crime and low-level crime.
Okay, thank you very much. And actually, we're just gonna go on through, because we're just a couple of minutes before we're going to start wrapping up here. So I wanted to talk about racism in policing, right? So I went over the stats earlier. I went over the wrongful convictions. What efforts are made in the state attorney's office? I mean, I asked a similar question to Seth, but to root out racism in policing and in the criminal justice system from you all's perspective. I know, again, the point system, and there were some other efforts made, but I think a lot of times those things don't get to the root of the problem. So what efforts, if any, have been made by the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office to address racism as it permeates throughout the entire system?
Sure. That's a great question, because there are racial disparities in the system. There's no disputing that. And there are other types of disparities, too. And there are a lot of economic disparities in the system. There's inconsistency, you know, from one case to the next. If we treat two identical cases, and I'm making air quotes because no two cases are truly identical, but we have very similar cases that may result in different outcomes. That's injustice. Mm-hmm. So what we've done in the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office is two things. One, we started a partnership with the University of South Florida Department of Criminology last year, where we invited the criminology department to come in and actually review our charges against juveniles to see where we are not being consistent, where disparities exist. Racial disparities, economic disparities, geographic disparities, you know, if there's a certain part of town where things are being handled differently than a different part of town, and consistency across the board. Keep in mind, a lot of prosecutors' offices don't like to open their kimono. They don't like to show what's happening inside. I'm, you know, committed to transparency, because transparency builds trust. So we have invited USF in to say, tell me what you're finding, the good, the bad, the ugly, and we're going to fix it.
Is that just juveniles, or is that just one
program? So that's just for juveniles, okay, just because it's, you know, USF's got their own things to do, right? So we don't want them to look over 75,000 cases a year. We're having them look at just at the juvenile cases. The other thing we've done, though, we were one of four cities across the country to have applied for and now been selected to participate in a groundbreaking national study with the MacArthur Foundation and researchers from Florida International University in Miami and Loyola out of Chicago to basically reevaluate how we evaluate things in the criminal justice system. Kai, you mentioned before, a lot of prosecutors' offices, you know, they look at conviction rates. That's a very poor way to measure whether we're doing a good job. But if you ask me what a good way is, I don't know. It's hard to tell you, because we actually haven't had those metrics historically. So this program is coming in and trying to, and it's soup to nuts, looking at data. It's actually increasing our data collection capability. And then we're having really smart statisticians, not lawyers, statisticians.
Right. We're not always good with the numbers.
I know, we're not. And look at the data and come back and say, here are things that you guys should be measuring. This is going to evaluate all the goals that I and the other prosecutors participating in the program have said are important to us: community safety, crime reduction, crime prevention, consistency, fairness, supporting victims. These are the metrics important to me. So we're having this data come in, and part of that is going to be looking at disparities, racial disparities, economic disparities. So this is a $1.7 million project being done over 2 years, groundbreaking, four cities: Tampa, Jacksonville, Chicago, and Milwaukee. And we are extremely excited to be one of those four cities who were invited to participate in this project.
Okay, well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that and seeing what results we get, because a lot of times you see things that, you know, that start out and, you know, the great intentions, and then the production is not what you would expect, which is why we continue to have these issues, quite frankly. This is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, and we are talking to State Attorney Andrew Warren, and we're about to wrap up here. Just have a couple of more questions, because I do want to get one more cut in by Dwele before we go and talk about our show next week. So I'm going to combine these last couple of questions. First of all, when it comes to those who've been wrongfully convicted, Seth talked a bit about kind of what happens afterwards, and you talked a little bit about that. So are there transition efforts that you all engage in to help those who you found who've been wrongfully convicted? And when it comes to compensation, I know we've got Florida Statute 961.06 that caps compensation at $2 million, but that's another transition type action that would be available to someone who has been wrongfully convicted. I think it's $50,000 a year, up to $2 million. So transition and compensation, you know, kind of combined. Is there anything that your office does in that regard?
Well, those issues, I mean, restituting people who have been wrongfully convicted are outside of sort of our jurisdiction.
But I mean, just kind of guiding them to where to go or whatever.
Well, we haven't gotten to that point yet. Okay. We just launched the unit in November. Right now, we're going through the screening process and the review process. And I talked about this as resource intensive. It's going to take some time.
Right.
If we find those cases, to go back and actually investigate the things that we need to.
Is that something you guys would consider as far as transition then?
We would. So ultimately, the key for us is if we find someone who's been wrongfully convicted, we have to vacate the conviction, right? We need to get them out of prison if they're still there.
Right.
We need to make sure that the conviction is not on the record anymore, which is a difficult process. So there are a lot of things that we would do when we get to the point which, God forbid, we find someone who's been wrongfully convicted.
Okay. And then finally, just to be clear, for people who may be wondering, this does not affect the appellate process in any way, right? So it's totally separate, kind of parallel tracks.
Correct. And again, you can learn more about the program at the State Attorney's Office website, sao13th.com. I would be remiss not to tell your listeners, you can follow the office on Twitter at sao13th. You can follow me at Andrew Warren FL. That's AndrewWarrenFL, because there's a lot more to learn about what's going on in the conviction review unit and all the great things that we're doing to make our community safer.
Okay, awesome. I'm a Twitter fanatic, so, you know, we'll see if that Twitter account's putting out some good content, or is it the kind you're like, okay, you know, scroll on past.
It's limited content because people don't want to hear about, you know, when I'm playing softball with my kids. But when we're talking about the criminal justice system.
Yes, I'm talking about the first one, not yours. You know. All right. Hey, well, thank you very much for taking the time to come out and explain the conviction review unit and what needs to happen for those who may have been wrongfully convicted and how they go through that process. I appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So we are about to wrap up here. Next week, we are going to be talking about Martin Luther King, but from a comprehensive perspective, not this content of character and rainbow in the sky, you know, type stuff that you're going to be hearing a lot of. We're going to be broadening, okay, and looking at it from the macro level and looking at the changes that Martin Luther King was making throughout the latter part of his life. Okay, so you want to tune in next week for that. You're going to hear clips and things you probably have never even heard before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that's what you get here at the Sunday Forum. All right, on 88.5 WMNF Tampa. So we're going to go out with Dwele. This is a favorite of whoever it was that called back a couple of weeks ago asking us about a Dwele song. So this is a nice little groove to go out on. It's called Find a Way by one of the Neo Soul Masters, Dwele.
would be the best of all friends. It turned to be L-O-V-E, and I was your man. So you was my lady friend. We spent time, I found a way to be by your side. Through the ins and outs, the wrongs and rights. After a while of being settled down, I didn't know how to keep the love, cause I was young. I wish I knew then what I know now. I wouldn't let you go. I swear I would've made this love.